This is The Conversation. It's episode 112 with Julio Cesar Morales, artist and curator of the Arizona State University Museum. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. And if you happen to listen to the last episode with Tulsa Kinney, I do want to confirm that the live conversation podcast that I refer to is indeed happening. We found our full lineup, and it is planned for Wednesday, September 9th at 7 p.m. The venue is in Los Angeles at the gallery Ochi Projects. That's O-C-H-I Projects. The address is 3301 West Washington Boulevard, Los Angeles. The zip is 90018. That's in the Arlington Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. And if you are a listener to this show and live in L.A., I hope and presume that you will be there. And the lineup for that event, not that you need the lineup, because you know that because it is a live conversation, it's an important event in itself, and it should be interesting regardless of what the topic is, but I will tell you that the lineup includes, in addition to myself, the independent curator and arts writer Katie Bode, the arts writer Matt Stromberg, and the artist Stephanie Pryor, and I can tell you that they have all been vetted, as all guests on this show are. So you know that they're going to deliver. And what we're going to be talking about, well, as I mentioned before, it generally has to do with the explosion of abstraction in the marketplace, the explosion of art objects in general, the divide between socially conscious / political art versus object art, etc. It's things that have been coming out that are coming up from the vents, the power of collectors, these kinds of things. I don't want to put too fine a point on it. It will go where it will go. But regardless, you're going to be there. It's going to be fun. And it's going to be a live conversation. So what more do you want? So Julio Cesar Morales is, the, as I said, an artist. He's also a co-member and creator of the artist collaborative Los Hijackers, along with Eamon, who I do allude to at one point. I don't have the full section where we talk about Los Hijackers, but just know that Eamon is his partner in that. And the other thing I need you to know as well is, one of the things we talk about towards the beginning is Julio's former artist-run space that he co-ran for a long time in San Francisco called Queen's Nails. They did a show there that turned into quite a fiasco and news event, because it was a piece that led to essentially a fire. Didn't cause super damage, but it definitely caused some. And more importantly, there were some issues with the fire department and whatnot. And it was a piece that was done by the artist collaborative Claire Fontaine. Now, I didn't realize, I was ignorant that Claire Fontaine was an artist collaborative. I mean, I knew the name because Julio had mentioned to me before, but they are, in fact, not, I had assumed it was a woman from Europe. And in fact, it is an artist collaborative. And the members, there apparently, according to Julio, there were three and now there are two, and they are Fulvia Carnevale and James Thornhill. And I think it might be worth noting those names once you hear the story about the Claire Fontaine installation at Queen's Nails that comes up in our conversation. So just wanted you to have that backstory. Otherwise, we get into some very interesting material, particularly around the border, immigration, and so on. Julio's series, Undocumented Interventions, led to some very interesting conversation about drug trafficking. And so look forward to that. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk a little bit more on the back end. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you in Los Angeles at Ochi Projects on September 9th. I will talk to you on the back end.
Michael.
Julio.
Hey.
Hey, ready to go? I think we would be remiss to not point out that you're in Phoenix, correct? This is you're my first Phoenix-based guest, and we're in the middle of August right now. So, Julio, what is the temperature there today?
Glad you asked me, Michael. It's 115. You know, at 120, planes don't take off or they don't land. I can't remember, but it's something to do with the tires.
Wow.
Wow. And so we're 5 degrees from the airport being closed.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you don't need to go anywhere at the moment, right?
No. No, not at all. Not this morning.
That's good. That's good. And for people who don't know you, you came from San Francisco just, what, about 3 years ago, is it now?
Yeah, I've been here almost 3 years. I took a position at the ASU Art Museum, the Arizona State University Art Museum.
Right.
And I came from SF, where I was there for about 20 years.
Got it. Yeah, so that's the reason I wanted to set that up that way, is because I imagine that on days like this, you can't help but think about being in San Francisco. Would that be accurate?
That's very accurate. And, you know, I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and they're having a heat spell, which kind of sucked because I was coming from 110-degree weather, and I was hoping to see some fog.
Yeah.
There was no fog. You know, it was more like L.A., you know, early
right.
80s. So it was kind of disappointing, but it was great to be back.
Yeah, yeah, got it. Okay. Well, one thing that I remember you mentioning about Arizona State, correct me if I'm wrong, is you said it's the biggest student population of universities in the country. Is that right?
That's right. There's about, I don't know, between 70, I believe something around 75,000 students. So it's the largest public university in the United States.
That's massive.
It is massive.
And where you live, is that sort of within the college town part of the university, or are you separate from that?
I'm separate. That is in Tempe, and that's where the museum is.
That's
the largest concentration of the university, and it has two other areas downtown and also one a bit more north.
What neighborhood are you in, for those of people who know Phoenix?
I'm in central Phoenix, so essentially downtown Phoenix, which is really great. It's more sort of bohemian in that sense, you know?
Right. And what about, I mean, since we're talking about Phoenix, and, you know, let's think about our listeners in Berlin and London, because we don't want to bore them. But for those that imagine Phoenix, and certainly people in the U.S. as a, I don't know, maybe a little conservative. I don't know. I guess Phoenix and Tucson are probably the most liberal outposts of Arizona, I'm going to guess. But how would you describe the general culture of Phoenix?
The general culture. You know, it is very right-wing Republican for the most part. And actually, Tucson is, if you consider maybe California, is sort of like the Berkeley of California.
Right.
So Tucson is the most kind of liberal city. Phoenix is sort of divided in that sense. But the rest of the cities in Arizona are pretty much conservative in that sense, yes.
Right.
Definitely.
But the people that
and
you...
You know,
I was just going to say, the people that you interact with sort of on a day-to-day basis, I mean, outside of the museum, are they people that probably share values with you, would you say?
If I share values with someone driving a Harley Davidson with their 45 and 3 extra flips onto their belt, I'm not sure about that. That's what I saw a couple of days ago. And, you know, everyone loves guns here. They love guns. And so, you know, it is permitted to have concealed weapons, have them out in the open. You know, one huge shock was when I actually came here, I took my son to the playground, and I had two visiting artists from Mexico, and this guy got up next to where we're sitting, and he pulls up his shirt and turns around to make sure that we know that he has a loaded gun in the back of his pants while his three-year-old daughter is playing in the playground.
Wow.
So that was my introduction to the gun culture here.
Right.
You know, why do you need guns to take your children to the playground? And the reaction is because of homeless people. Homeless people have guns.
Wow. Do any homeless people actually have guns? I would be very surprised if they do.
I would be surprised as well.
Yeah.
I think they're more interested in other things.
How old is your son?
I have two sons. One is, he's now 5, almost 6, and another is 1.5.
Wow. Now, do you have your hands full not only raising your sons, but raising them in an environment where you go to a playground and some kid's dad has got a gun on him?
Yeah, you have to be extra cautious, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, one thing that happened when I was working on my first show here, which was from the collection of Humex in Mexico City, I forgot where I was, and this guy started talking shit to the artist I was working with. We were on the public light rail.
Uh-huh.
And I just told him, shut the fuck up and sit down. And
uh-oh.
He just did a double take, and he sat down, and then he started to take his bag out. And every time he would mention something else to us, he would take out a crowbar. Then he would take out a screwdriver that's been filed at the, you know, at the edges and so on. Until the last draw, he took out two bullets that were inside his ears. And when I saw that, I'm like, shit, I'm not in California anymore. I got to backtrack. And then I actually said, hey, we were just saying you have some really cool sneakers and so on. And then everything changed after that.
Wow.
And the police showed up, and you know, everyone else freaked out that I was in the same car with us.
Wow. So you know,
I do forget where I am sometimes, but at the same time, you do have to be extra cautious, you know, especially with kids.
I think that's what you did, though, sounds like a great strategy, and it's something that I heard about recently in another podcast that a woman was talking about this problem she was having with this coworker who was basically being really mean to her and not
mm-hmm.
sort of you know, giving her growls and being passive aggressive in all sorts of way, and she ended up killing her with kindness. You know, she just was as sweet as she could possibly be, and the problem eventually went away. So it sounds like that's a good strategy for you when you're confronted with these kinds of situations.
Yeah, that's a really great strategy, and I would stand by it.
Right. Got it. Well, so being the curator of the Arizona State Museum, is that a big venue? Are you able to get visitors to come in to see the shows from outside of town, or is it more, how would you describe it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of flexibility and openness on behalf of the university and the director as well. So I would describe it, you know, as a university museum that you're allowed to experiment more. You know, all the projects that I'm bringing in are mostly commission-based work, so it's new work, not traveling exhibitions.
Right.
It's more focused on supporting artists through our residency program as well. But, you know, when I first thought of taking the job, I ended up writing a letter to the director, and in my letter, which my wife said not to send, I wrote, why do I want to go from one of the most liberal cities in the United States to the most oppressive for Latinos?
Mm-hmm.
And my wife said, don't send it. And I'm like, I got to send it. And, you know, if you're interested, this is the type of program that I'm going to be doing in that sense.
Right.
And so when I finally met the director, he said he loved it, and that's what convinced me to hire him.
Wow.
Because, I mean, I had not applied for a job in 9 years.
Uh-huh.
I had 5 different jobs for 9 years in San Francisco.
Right. Which is probably normal, I would imagine, for in the arts, right? A lot of movement.
I think for an artist, it is quite normal to teach at 3 universities.
Yeah.
And do your own work, maybe do some public art, or, you know what I mean? So you kind of balance things out as a working artist. You do have to take all those gigs. You know, it's very difficult to find, like, you know, a tenure position or even just a regular faculty position.
Right.
So if you want to be independent and you just want to continue doing your work you in your own terms, you kind of suffer for it in that sense that you have to have multiple jobs.
Yeah. It sounds like, from what you're describing, your job mission and position is now having the freedom and the flexibility to create new shows, that it sounded like an appealing opportunity coming from an artist-run space beforehand, where you had that same kind of freedom.
Yes, exactly. But you do have a support system, and you know, you have installers, you have a, you know, an okay budget, you know, and so on. So
right.
I mean, to have a venue like that to support, and also the university is very, very open, and they're not conservative whatsoever.
Right.
So even difficult shows, like I have a show right now that everyone freaked out about because it's a project by Joshua Alcon, a Mexico City artist that was interested in meeting the Minutemen.
Right.
From an article he read,
mm-hmm.
and we made it happen, and he did a reenactment of a protest. that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of guns and machine guns in the video, the 4-channel video, so it's quite interesting. So they just wanted to know, you know, what the project was about, and then there's plans of evacuation that are a reality, and so on. So we have these meetings, and I let them know, I show them the work, and then they're like, okay, we understand it, we stand behind it, and if someone shows up, and these are the plans of evacuation, if they show up with, you know, submachine guns.
Wow. So to clarify, the piece, the reenactment of a Minutemen protest, is that what you call it, or a march?
It's a protest they did against the recent youth coming from Central America.
Right, right.
You know, there's been about 60,000 kids from age 8 to 17 just walking,
right,
hopping on you know, on trains to get here to reunite with families or escape, you know, bad situations.
Right.
And essentially, when they're caught, they're being sent to these camps or juvenile halls. And there's one in a town called Oracle that's 2 hours from here.
I see.
And that's where they did their protest.
Got it. So what I'm trying to clarify is when Joshua Ocone did the reenactment, was he actually using actual Minutemen to play their parts, or was it all actors who are playing Minutemen?
No, they're the real people. They're the people who, you know, the main leader, and then people who were there. So essentially, you know, that's what his work is about, in
right,
the sense of you know, reenacting and using, you know, normal people as actors and so on.
Right.
You know, and so they're not called Minutemen anymore because the leader got caught with child pornography.
Mm.
So now they've changed their name to Arizona Border Protectors.
I see.
And so, you know, we ended up going to the town, and he ended up meeting with the leader and telling him, this is what I do. This is what I want to do, and show your perspective, you know, what really makes you, I don't know, what's your philosophy and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so essentially the video came after that, and they all agreed to be part of it, and they are the real protesters.
Got it. So the obvious question then becomes, to what extent in their interaction with the artist and subsequent the exhibition itself, did their perspectives begin to change, if at all?
Well, you know, people change when you have a camera in front of them.
Yeah.
But they seemed pretty comfortable, and of course they wanted their message to go out into media, and, you know, it's a university museum, there's press releases, and most likely the show is going to be traveling. And so essentially they did a couple of actions with the protest, and these actions, they started to pull out their guns and talk about their philosophy and actually shoot guns while they're driving round and round in circles.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that they set up with Joshua. So it wasn't like, hey, why don't we do this? It was more like, I want to continue talking about, you know, what we believe in, and this might be a good situation to videotape.
Right, right.
And, you know, in the end, it's not about racism or even topics of migration, immigration. It's really about nationalism, you know? What they, you know, they're more angry with the government than these kids.
I see. Well,
and that's sort of like what comes across in the video.
I see. Well, see, I'm wondering more, though, big picture wise, if if they have the awareness, the cognizance to recognize that Ocone is not just giving them some kind of free platform, you know, that actually he is exposing them, you know, for their over-the-top behavior, essentially, and, you know, and maybe that they will catch on to that, and somehow there will be some kind of
retaliation.
Well, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say some kind of recognition of what's going on, and, you know, and maybe that seems like a really idealistic way of looking at it, but I guess it's a very nuanced kind of thing, and maybe, you know, I don't know. What do you think what Ocone's objective ultimately is?
I think, you know, they're so embedded in their ideology that I think Joshua is just kind of blown away by how open they were and in a way generous with, you know, exposing themselves to the camera. But he also didn't, it's so easy to demonize someone like the Minutemen or the Border Protectors.
Right.
So he really wanted to talk more of a general portrait of nationalism, and also, you know, because of the state of Arizona, it's against the law to teach ethnic studies or any kind of other form other than American history in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those kinds of issues and social climate is what kind of motivated him to do this project. But I think, as you mentioned, that, you know, this type of work, you know, again, they're so embedded with their archaeology that they think they're completely 100% correct. And
right.
and they stand by it.
I see. Okay. Got it. Well, let's switch gears. I want to, because there's so much that you have done in San Francisco that I think we need to start looking into that. The main thing that people should know about is that you ran the artist-run space, Queen's Nails Gallery, in the Bernal Heights neighborhood of San Francisco, a beautiful neighborhood, which I've been to myself a couple of times. When did that start, and talk about what the genesis of that was?
Let me see. Okay, so it started in 2005, and, you know, the point of starting the space was, at this point, and at that time, it was the first sort of dot-com boom that was happening,
mm-hmm.
and so you started to lose artist-run spaces and nonprofits, and things that I benefited from being a student at the San Francisco Art Institute and people from my generation, where it was an amazing support system to, you know, have shows, performances, whatever, things that really supported the art scene through these smaller independent spaces. And then they started to go away, and I had a chance to actually open a space, and I just took it because, in a way, out of necessity, like, this is what needs to happen again in San Francisco, because at that time, it's sort of what's happening now, where you're seeing the disappearance of these independent spaces. And so we started the project. I started with Liz Mulholland, who's now in New York. And that's how it came about, actually.
Uh-huh. What's the name of your co-creator?
Liz Mulholland.
Liz.
She's the director of Andrew Crick's Gallery in New York.
Ah, wow. That's quite a change of venue.
yes, definitely.
So she came... in other words, she came from more of a curatorial background as opposed to an artist background?
Yes, she did. She was studying visual criticism.
Uh-huh.
But she also worked for Stephen Works Gallery, which was a really great photo space in San Francisco. But she came more from a curatorial standpoint, and I came from a more artistic standpoint.
Yeah, got it. And how was it that you chose Bernal Heights as the venue? Was that just a question of the storefront, the space that you used was a price you could afford?
Yeah, and she lives around the corner. And then we talked about, let's open this space. And we actually were looking for spaces. And then there was this spot that was closed for 5 years.
Right.
And it was just boarded up. And somehow we got a hold of the landlord, and we convinced them to rent us a space, which was an old Filipino bakery,
mm-hmm.
essentially, for most of its life.
Mm-hmm.
And next door, I should say, that there's a Real Queen's Nails, which is a nail salon that's
right.
been there 30 years. And so I couldn't get over the notion and the beauty of the sign, so we just added Annex.
So we Queen's space. Nails Annex.
Yes, Queen's Nails Annex was the official first name.
Right.
And it took 2 years for them to find out that we were using her name, that we hijacked her name. And, you know, we had some artists from Denmark, and they sent some catalogs, and it actually arrived to the nail shop. So I had to go there like an hour before the show opened and ask them, and they just laughed, and they said, no wonder people call us and ask us what exhibitions we're having.
Right. That's funny.
And so they're really great, and so we ended up collaborating with them on a different show of other Mexico City artists, where half of the work was at the actual nail shop.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that began all these other pretty amazing series of exhibitions and artists working with us.
It sounds like, just based on the, I'm basing it just on the one Danish artist you mentioned, and then the Claire Fontaine French artist, that,
mm-hmm.
that you brought in a number of international artists. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, it was like, it was either local... Yeah, it was local, national, and international. You know, and the great thing about being an artist is you have shows. You have international shows. You go to different countries, and then you meet other artists, and those connections evolve, and then you basically ask them to collaborate and have an exhibition.
Right.
So a lot of those connections were because I was an artist.
Right, got it. And it sounds like the most notorious or infamous show that you had at Queen's Nails was the Claire Fontaine installation. Would you agree?
Yeah. It was the most stressful for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, at this point, I was working with Bob Linder, who's another visual artist. He just moved back from New York to San Francisco. And he loves their work, and so we ended up working with them. And they have this series of works that they basically, it's based on financial debts that different countries have.
Right.
And so they did one for France, they did one for, I can't remember which other countries they did this, but this one was the United States.
Right.
So it was made out of 50,000 matchsticks. I mean, but the wooden sticks.
Right.
So we had to individually drill 50,000 fucking holes into the wall. And
how long did that take?
Never helped whatsoever.
Right.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to, since you set that up, I wanted to ask you how long that took and how many people you had working on that.
I think we had between 5 and 10 people working for about 2 or 3 weeks.
And the artist was not involved at all in that preparation?
No, that's, you know, if they have this methodology with that piece that they don't touch it whatsoever.
Really?
Once it's installed, which looks really beautiful,
yeah,
they have the curator or someone from the gallery light it.
Was that you?
No, it was Bob. It was Bob because we were filming it because the opening was the next day.
Right.
And I was in Phoenix.
Right.
And so I was going to come the next day. And I went actually a week before because we were supposed to have the opening, but we didn't have enough help to finish the damn map.
Mm-hmm.
So we postponed it for a week, mm-hmm. and they burnt it. Bob lit it, and, you know, it just turned into a shitstorm, basically. You know, there's people in there, and it just, you know, there's just a fog of just smoke everywhere. And, you know, they eventually just did put it out with hoses because they did have hoses there. And all of a sudden, you know, police and fire trucks showed up.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it was top news. You know.
Yeah, you got a lot of press out of it. That's for sure.
Yes. So that was an exhibition that basically could only be seen from the outside of the space. I mean, it looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's burnt into the wall and basically it leaves this amazing material onto the wall itself, and so it creates like a beautiful imprint. So it worked really well, and we had a neon piece and a couple other videos attached to that. But, you know, in the morning, we just had everyone in the newscast in San Francisco calling us for interviews or to come into the gallery.
Right. Well, you can see a YouTube video of the France version of the burnt matchsticks. And that one, it appears to be under control. It's burning, but, you know, it's not getting out of control. So did she give you instructions or indication,
yes,
and you followed them and it still happened? Is that basically how it went down?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, we're an independent artist run space, so if when an artist wants to experiment, we're like, okay, yeah, sure, we'll do that. But, you know, we did put fire repellent material on the wall.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we took all those steps.
Right.
The problem is that there's no exit door.
Mm.
There's only one door in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was so much smoke that when everyone just ran out, there's a huge amount of that. You saw that going into the street itself.
I see.
All the smoke just came out and people were freaking out. And there's actually 3 apartments upstairs, but they've all been empty for 10 years.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So people freaked out and they thought the whole building was on fire. And,
right,
you know, Vernon Heights, you know, it's a very close neighborhood,
mm-hmm,
in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So people started freaking out and, you know, 5 fire trucks showed up. And then Bob, because he was there and responsible, not the artist. The artist was there and the artist actually fucking took off.
Wow.
They, as soon as the fire and the police came, they fucking left. And so, you know, Bob lit it, right? So
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
his ass on the line. So he had to go to court, and we were looking at $250,000 in fees and jail time.
Wow.
For Bob.
Wow.
And me for being like the other, you know, it's my lease, you know what I mean? It's
right.
My name on the lease.
Right.
So we're looking at serious jail time, And then there's a really amazing foundation called TADF in San Francisco that they also have a great space. And they offered to buy the neon in the exhibition for us to get a lawyer. You know, we didn't have, you know, come on, we're artists. We don't have lawyers.
Sure.
And so Claire Fontaine said no because they wanted $5,000 more for it. And I thought, that is fucking ridiculous. If you almost burn someone's place down, or you do burn someone's place down, the least you can do is give an artwork so they can pay for the legal fees.
Right.
Or not spend time in jail.
Right.
And so that piece never sold at all.
Because she wanted $5,000 more than you were originally asking, and they didn't want to take that.
Well, I think, you know, the director said, hey, you know, I can pay $10,000 for this piece, you know, but I can't go higher. Is this okay? And we said, okay, we'll ask Claire Fontaine people. And they said, no, that's too low. And I'm like, your work is supposed to be about, you know, critical dialogue and inquiry and the economics and so on and anarchy. And then all of a sudden, it's all about the money. You know, that's really contradictory.
Sounds like she burnt a couple of bridges there. No pun slightly intended.
Well, you know, the funniest thing is that we actually did a couple of art fairs towards the end of Queen's Nails, and we went to NADA in New York. We actually met the director of their gallery, Metro Pictures, at NADA.
Uh-huh.
The first thing he says is like, God, I'm so sorry. They didn't even give you the piece.
Wow.
And he apologized on behalf of the gallery. And if he would have known, he would have done something, he said. But
wow.
Essentially, no piece was sold. We ended up getting other friends of friends to represent the gallery.
Uh-huh.
And things got reduced to working community hours. And we paid maybe $2,000.
Okay. Okay.
Of course we paid it.
Yeah.
Not them.
Yeah. 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 Wow.
So we fixed up the gallery afterwards. So it was fine. It wasn't, there was more smoke than actual damage.
Sure.
You know, it actually damaged a little bit on the top, but we fixed it up. The owner of the building came the next morning right after the fire. And he said, don't worry about it. And the building was sold essentially, and you know, they sold it for a couple million dollars.
Right.
And so, you know, the guy had this building since the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't have, you know, he didn't have to spend any money on it. So he just had it, and you know, he was just happy that someone was using it. He actually was very supportive of the gallery.
Right. Well, was that the last show? That wasn't the last show that Queen's Nails did, was it?
No, that was going to be, let's see, what happened is, of course, legally, it should have been, or it could have been, the last show.
Yeah.
So we ended up having two other projects, and then Bob wanted to start or take over the space, and it's really difficult to work, you know, more than full-time in Phoenix and then still be part of the gallery.
Right.
So I thought it would be a great idea if he just took it over under his name, and it's no longer Queen's Nails. But then he decided not to do it at the last minute and was moving to Los Angeles. And the last show actually was supposed to be Kim Gordon. And we were working through another curator, and that just kind of fell apart. And so after that, the last show, you know, was sort of a pun, but also at the same time, it was off the Smiths, The Queen is Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the album?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was called Queen's Nails is Dead. And basically, it was Queen's Nails is Dead, and it was three artists that were influenced, that basically influenced each other, different generations. It was Daniel J. Martinez, Marco Rios that you've had on your show,
yeah,
and Jerome Reyes. So
mm-hmm.
Daniel influenced Marco, and Marco influenced Jerome. And
mm-hmm.
so I kind of wanted to have this last sort of exhibition as a cross-generational influential, you know, type of exhibition.
Right, right. So essentially,
that was technically the last one.
So essentially, the gallery, the closing of the gallery coincided more with your moving to Phoenix.
Yes,
got it.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I you know, especially after Claire Fontaine.
Yeah,
it was just insane, and you know, it cost money. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I would have paid for it if I would sell artwork. I would put it back into the gallery,
right,
or do some public art, or
right.
You know, there were the system that was in place, and why it actually worked really well is that the second half of the space were artist studios.
Mm.
And that paid three quarters of the rent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was really manageable to come up with, you know, $800 a month.
Right.
Besides cost, or, you know, there's never any budget for artists. Once in a while, I would sell something and I would give an artist $500.
Right. What do you think?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I keep going back to the Clairefontaine situation. What do you feel like the takeaway from that is? I mean, does it make you more cynical and feel like you need to sign contracts with your artists, you know, or how do you see it?
In that kind of environment, we never had any contracts.
Right.
At all. You know, of course, now that I work for a university museum, there's too much of that bureaucracy going on.
Sure.
But I think as advice, as opposed to another artist-run space, I think it is good to have contracts. And, you know, because with the contract, it doesn't have to be a hefty one, but, you know your obligations as a gallery and what you're going to produce on your end for the artist or the exhibition. So it's nice to be clear. I'm going to do this for you. You're going to be bringing this and we'll do the show.
Yeah.
So in a way, that formality, you know, never existed because it was so fluid. But I think in retrospect, it would be great if we would have had something like that.
Sure.
I mean, we work with other artists that, you know, maybe they weren't the happiest artists there, but for the most part, 95% of all the shows, people were just really into it. And right. You know, we've had like first solo shows by all these phenomenal artists, national and international there. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely one thing I did learn from that experience of 9 years.
Got it. Yeah. Well, and as far as that artist, I mean, she obviously, you know, lit her reputation with that event. So.
Yeah.
So she's got her own mess to clean up. So some of the other projects that you or spaces that you were involved with over San Francisco. So you both went to the Art Institute, San Francisco Art Institute, and you also taught there. Is that correct?
Yes, I taught there for 12 years.
And
I
you
was
were
adjunct for 12 years.
And one of the projects that you were involved with while teaching there was correct me if I'm wrong, is the George Cuchar sort of retrospective.
Exactly.
Got it. Well, let's talk about him for a little bit, because I think he's a bit of a legend, but one not particularly well known throughout the art world. Mm-hmm. So he was
right.
You could kind of describe him as one of the classic sort of experimental filmmakers and then video makers. Wouldn't you say? Is he originally was most of his career spent in San Francisco or the Bay Area?
Well, you know, with him, with his twin brother, they started making films, I believe, at, you know, the age of like 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but they, you know, they're in the New York scene for quite a long time. They influenced people like John Waters, Andy Warhol, David Lynch, all these phenomenal other artists. And then they came to the Bay Area, and George taught at the San Francisco Art Institute, and he would teach experimental cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had another class where they would make one class video or picture a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty amazing. And so I ended up, when I was a student at SFA, I actually never took a class from him. I actually met him after the fact when I was teaching there. And I was working with an artist named Miguel Calderon from Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
And I took this position at Irvine Center for the Arts, again, another adjunct position for a curator. And I developed a series of projects that were more laboratory-based, you know, almost like the next step up from Queen's Nails in a way, I suppose I can see it that way.
Uh-huh.
And so Miguel wanted to do a collaboration with George Cuchar. So I approached George, and they went off to Acapulco to film an amazing, I guess what they call it is the most amazing underground film you'll never see.
Uh-huh.
And I commissioned them to do a 15-minute video, and I sent a video crew from San Francisco to go with them, and from L.A. They spent almost 3 weeks there in Acapulco, and they ended up shooting a feature-length movie. And
uh-huh.
Everyone on the set was emailing me, telling me how amazing the project was and so on, until the last day after the final shot. I'm not sure what happened, but they were all staying in these two condos, and someone claimed that the hard drive got knocked over, and there's only one hard drive. They weren't backing up, and so essentially they lost 95% of all the footage.
Wow.
And I even took it to where the FBI takes their hard drives in Orange County,
and they
couldn't retrieve it.
Wow.
They said you would have a better chance if someone would have thrown it into a swimming pool. And so there were other cameras that were being that are also shooting, and at the end they did create this beautiful 15-minute piece, but they lost everything else.
Wow.
And that was the first time that George actually got a passport because he's never been out of the United States.
Huh.
And so from then on, we became very good friends, and Miguel and I curated like a mini retrospective of his work in New Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
We actually did one as a curator with Marco at his space in L.A. as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really great exhibition. And so when George unfortunately passed away, right before he passed away, I told him that, what state he was in. So he flew to San Francisco and did an interview with him, and he passed away a couple of days later. And so I was asked by San Francisco Institute, because of my relationship, and I already started to create this kind of survey show of George, to actually curate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, my thought was, if you ever been to George Cuchar and Mike's place in San Francisco, you see the remnants of the last 50 years of their work.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these crazy, knickknacks or props that were in their film, and they're right there in their studio and in their living room, and posters and images. And, it's an amazing space, very magical in that apartment. So I wanted people to feel as if you're coming into George's studio or his apartment. So we literally took, Mike was very supportive, his twin brother, because they lived together till the end. And he was very supportive, like, just take whatever you want. And the first thing is, I remember what his master tapes were. And I opened the drawer, and they were all empty. There was no master tape at all.
Right.
And Mike looks at me, he's like, oh, you just missed the Harvard archives. They took all the master tapes.
Mm.
And I was like, shit, what are we going to do? And then I remember that he always kept a copy of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a closet that Mike showed me. And essentially, there was 16mm Super 8, and then there's the video format, high 8, regular 8, 3/4 inch, VHS, Super VHS. So I ended up showing 150 films.
Wow.
in their format I found them in.
Mm-hmm.
So then we designed a space that it's sort of like walking again into his apartment and studio, but there was these ancient machines of Super 8, 3/4 inch, and people could actually play them and choose what they wanted to look at. And there were some projections, some monitors. There was an amazing section that was a listening room, and that was all his records that he would place in his movies. So, 16mm, and then Mike told me he had a hiding place in SFAI. And so I went there, and we cut this lock, and there was like this amazing, magical treasure of original 16mm prints.
Mm.
So we ended up duplicating, 175 pieces, and out of that, 150 is what we were showing. And, it just turned out to be a really fantastic exhibition, one of the best experiences as a curator, even though George wasn't there.
Yeah.
But his spirit really lived in that sense. And I also worked with Hu Hanru, who was leaving SFA at that moment, but he wasn't around. So the thing that we did is we sort of designed the show together without any levels. So that was actually pretty fun.
Well, maybe we should switch over to some of your work now. So you were in this show at LACMA, Phantom Sightings, Art After the Chicano Movement, which was a few years ago, 2008 actually, so
yes.
Several years ago now.
Right.
But that was a pretty big deal of a show. So I think the first question is, how do you see yourself in terms of that kind of historicization? And, is that a context that you feel comfortable being associated with?
One, an amazing experience to be part of that project, and I worked really closely with Rita Gonzalez, one of the curators. And, I wasn't completely comfortable with it.
Right.
I mean, because one, Chicano is an assigned sort of role, I understand the historical aspect and that movement in the 60s, the Chicano movement in the 60s, and I associate more with the political aspect of that as opposed to the aesthetics of Chicano art.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I remember because Eamon was also in that show.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked together at both Hijackers as well as my own work in that exhibition.
Okay.
And we were being interviewed by the LA Times, by NPR, I forget what other major media. And they asked us, so, you know, are you Chicano? And I said, no, I'm not Chicano. Chicano self-identified in that sense. I identify and I believe in the movement as a political action, but not, I don't relate to the artistic aesthetics of Chicano art.
Yeah, that I guess that's when you combine the words Chicano and art, you do think of a very particular kind of aesthetic. So it's hard to take the word Chicano and interpret it as a more generally cultural kind of movement or time.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that was one of the objectives for the curator is, you know, what is after this aesthetic of Chicano art
right.
and movement.
Right.
And so, you know, they chose really amazing artists to be in the exhibition. I think for the most part, every artist kind of went beyond your typical idea of what Chicano art is
yeah.
or should be.
Yeah. Even though, let's get for a second, I want to
sure.
go back to Phoenix, you know, where you are now. Obviously, San Francisco is, you know, is a very Latino embedded culture. To what extent? And you mentioned earlier that Phoenix, you know, or that Arizona, you know, was part of its law essentially is harsh to
exactly.
To Latinos or certainly to people from Mexico who, you know, who are undocumented and what have you. What do you feel like it is, you know, in Phoenix as far as that kind of cultural identity? That community?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different, you know, there's the activist side. There is a lot of Latino activism happening here,
mm-hmm.
you know, out of necessity because of these really stupid laws.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are conservative Latinos here in the same way that you have conservative Latinos, say, in Miami, in Texas. You know, people that have been here for a very long period of time, that very classic idea or notion that the border did not cross us, you know, in that sense that they've been here for generations and their background is Mexican, but they feel more in line with the Anglo side here.
Yeah.
So it's very, you know, it's a very weird place to be. And it's funny you mentioned that in sightings because the majority of the artists that were in that exhibition, because this was also a traveling exhibition, this exhibition of Phantom Sightings actually came to Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
and half of the artists or more boycotted coming here.
Wow.
Which included me and Eamon. So we like, why do we want to go? Fuck no, no way. And when I came here, I thought, well, fuck, that was the wrong way of going about it. You know, there's one thing to protest and just say something, and there's another way to insert yourself in that climate, in that situation, and try and change things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of change happening here, you know, and a lot of it does have to do with, say, like ASU being a large institution and actually gaining more Latino students. But also, it's very hard. For example, there's these hunger strikes that were happening last year where police would pick up undocumented people and they would basically throw them in jail and they had no say and they wouldn't take them out and then they became immigration cases. And they couldn't speak to their families, and some people didn't know that. Basically, they were disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have any contact with them. And then when these hunger strikes were happening outside the ICE building in one of the main streets here, people would come by, and they would buy burritos from Chipotle, and they would throw them at the people who were in the hunger strike.
Wow.
Now, that's fucked up.
Yeah, that's totally fucked up.
Yeah. So you can kind of see that in relationship to, it's a struggle here. It really
yeah.
is a struggle. But, you know, there are some really amazing organizations that are attempting to make change. Some of them are associated with ASU. Some of them associated with, you know, maybe the city itself in a smaller scale. I did bring a project by an artist named Pablo Higuera from New York, and his project was 10,000 books. Spanish language books that were donated to him, and he opened a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a bookstore of 10,000 books, Spanish language authors in Spanish, and that seemed radical, you know, and it was the only Spanish language bookstore in Phoenix. in a city of, you know, a million people that speak Spanish.
Right.
He also had this the same project travel to New York, and again, it was the only Spanish language bookstore in New York. Mm-hmm. And we also took it to San Francisco. So, and that was the same thing. It was the only Spanish language bookstore. You know, besides religious bookstores, you know, one, the book is superior, and two, you know, the language barrier as well. It's quite interesting to look at.
Right.
And people loved that project. And, you know, book clubs formed, people had rallies in there and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting, this moment in Phoenix right now as well.
Yeah, it sounds like the sentiment that you're describing of changing things from within is hugely, I would imagine, informs your programming at the museum.
Yeah, definitely.
One other thing that I want to talk about, going back to phantom sightings, so the work that you had as an individual as opposed to your collaborative project were these undocumented intervention pieces?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't, as a general rule these days, I tend to prefer, try to avoid talking about work on an audio medium, but in this case, I think it's an absolute necessity. So you did this series of called undocumented interventions, which essentially are what could be described as people trying to stealthily get themselves across borders, or you know, they're smuggling themselves. You know, in airplane overhead cabins, in the airplane seats, or in
washing machines, yeah,
right, or in toys, you know, or costumes, like anything from SpongeBob SquarePants to a Tweety Bird. What's that?
Those are piñatas.
Piñatas. Thank you. So the first thing that I want to make note of, not just of the work itself, but the fact that you led me to a slideshow of this work on the website of Juxtapose. And I think that's really noteworthy because it's a subject that's starting to come up more and more frequently around the podcast. And I like to describe, you know, you can talk, people talk about there are many different art worlds, but for me, it really kind of mainly comes down to two different art worlds. There is the proper, quote unquote, proper high art world, and then there's the juxtapose art world. And so by juxtapose, including your undocumented interventions work on their site, to me, that feels like a true crossover. And I wonder if you felt that way about it in any sense.
Well, this is incredibly funny, Michael, because when you said send me links to other projects, and I have no idea who put that up on juxtapose.
Right.
And I just found it, and it's like a PowerPoint, a slideshow. I'm like, who the hell put that up? I have no idea. You know, juxtapose sells more copies than our forum, you know?
That's not surprising, yeah.
And it's funny. I just found it. And, I mean, I think that work to be included in the LACMA show, I think, was incredibly important. And this work is based on my upbringing because I grew up in Tijuana. And then I moved a block away to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really weird because I was doing a show at the San Diego Museum of Contemporary Art, and I saw in the newspaper that a four-year-old girl was trying to be smuggled into the United States inside a Powerpuff Girl piñata.
Wow.
And they ripped the legs of the piñata because it was heavier than the other piñatas that were in the car. And I popped out a four-year-old girl.
Right.
And so I started to research and read more about it, and it turns out all this is being done where I grew up in Tijuana in a place called Zona Norte. You know, a lot of people in Southern California know you can go to Tijuana and get your car reupholstered or painted. And so the same people who are doing that, for $500, they'll take out the dashboard of a car, they'll put you inside the dashboard and put it back together again.
Wow.
Or they'll make a custom piñata of SpongeBob to fit the body of your kid.
Right.
And so this is actually not a backlash, but this is a very creative way that these people are thinking, because after 9/11, you know, the borders are a lot tighter. You know, they're finishing an $8 billion, you know, new fence.
Yeah.
And the response from people who don't have access to lots of money, and these are people who had seasonally worked in the United States and it would cross over and come back and so on, and it was easier to do that before 9/11. And so now people who are undocumented are staying in the United States because they can't really come back because it's very difficult. So they're trying to unite with their children. And one of the ways they're trying to do that is very lo-fi and very creative and stuffing them in piñata.
Wow.
Or, you know, having your wife, you know, in a car seat, or your husband or your uncle, you know what I mean? So these are incredibly creative and really difficult ways of doing this. And the reality of it, I wanted to create the work with the softest media for me. And to me, the softest media is watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
And so I show, you know, and everything, it comes from the INS website. So these are all the watercolors are actual events, and they're all posted on the INS website.
So you're
so
just
I go through it and I find those images and mm-hmm. I just recreate them.
Wow. Wow. I think that's incredibly surprising, because when I looked at these, I thought, wow, that's really creative that he, you know, that he's that's an excellent way to appropriate an image for sure. On a practical level, I can't help but wonder,
sure.
And I'm sure you've been, you know, you've thought about this quite a bit yourself, but what about the practical survival elements? Like, are there oxygen tanks included in, you know, inside these car cabins, or how does that work?
No. I mean, these are interventions that cost less than $500.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like a safe passage with a coyote going through a certain part of the desert or something, that'll cost you like starting rates like about $2,500.
Right.
So this is an even cheaper way to get across. But if, you know, if you can imagine, now it takes about 4 hours, you know, between 2 to 4 hours to cross the border. And so if you can imagine being inside a dashboard for 8 hours.
Yeah.
There's no sophisticated, you know, oxygen, or, you know, maybe there's a straw that is connected to the to one of the vents or something, but
yeah.
It's super, super low tech.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it sounds like you're, in some cases, if it's 8 hours, you're risking death.
Yes, definitely.
Wow.
You are.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's another friend that my aunt turned me on to, and I gave them a certain amount of money and they let me into their workshop.
Right.
And one thing that they're doing is, this hasn't been caught on yet, but basically hollowing out big logs or tree trunks,
mm-hmm.
putting either drugs or people in the logs, sealing it, and just letting it float down the river.
Wow.
So yeah, people are, you know, like, and this is a global thing now, you know, you have all those drowning
Yeah,
that are happening,
that's right.
You know, people trying to get to Europe, you know, from
that's
Africa,
right.
from, you know, and so on. So it's, you know, it's a global thing now. And so I'm thinking of it more from where I came from, what I do.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that I come from a sort of complicated family, that some people were smugglers, some people were drug dealers. My cousin was the youngest judge in Baja California. When I was a kid, I used to actually dig tunnels for my uncle.
Wow.
And we weren't sure why we were doing it. He would just take us to see wrestling matches, and me and my brother and my cousin, and we would just be digging tunnels. And we never really asked why. And so all this work that I do actually comes from experience in that sense, or family experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you had conversations with people who've been through these interventions?
A couple, yeah.
Can you tell me what those have been like?
Yeah, one in dashboard, and so basically they told me kind of like what they saw, and I created a video that was part of Phantom Sighting that you would see the watercolors, and there was a video projection, and it was really simple. It's just a video that was shot from one place where they do these alterations to cars into crossing the border, and essentially this person told me that when you're inside, you know, after a certain amount of time, things begin to double. And so from the description of this person I created, I kind of altered the video to look from that perspective. So when you would see the installation at LACMA, you would also see a video that was influenced by someone who had done this, and what kind of state they were in, and what things looked like visually from, you know, usually your only way to see anything would be through these vents that you have on the dashboard.
Right. Huh. You know,
so it's a very psychedelic kind of looking video.
I'm thinking, and you know, obviously this is a low cost operations, so there's not a lot of preparation, I would imagine, that goes on to these things. But I would think that if you were to take the most thorough approach, that you would involve, you know, various kinds of meditation, preparations into this, so that you could get into a relaxed state and one in which your heartbeat really, really drops down. You know, there was it Skip Arnold who did the piece where he was in the box, you know, for a long period of time. So, you know, it's that kind of training that seems like it would be optimal, but that's not the way it works here. This is quick and dirty, and they're in there, and it's like survive the best you can.
Yeah, I mean, if you thought about it for a second, maybe you'd pop a muscle relaxer or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, but other than that, no. I mean, there's more training when you deal with drugs.
Right,
you know?
Sure.
But not if you're just smuggling yourself in that sense, because usually when you do that, it's not like a coyote that you pay. It's someone that you know. So whenever this happens, it's always like a relative, or it's always someone that a friend or something that you're, you know, quote unquote, working with. You know, so it's not a coyote type of thing.
Yeah,
and that's someone, a smuggler that you pay to get you across, basically, is what it means.
Was your own experience transitioning from Tijuana to San Diego one without any kind of peril, or?
No, I mean, you know, my mom and dad had been working in San Diego, you know, for like 20 years when we ended up immigrating there. So, you know, I didn't have to do it in that sense, in that way. And, you know, back then in the early 80s, it was also a lot more fluid. You could, you know, walk across and drive across like in 10 minutes.
Right. Sure. But what was their process of getting citizenship or green cards?
Well, you know, since they worked in the United States for so long, it was quite easy because I'm not sure if this is happening anymore, but if your parent would become a U.S. citizen, you know, you have to apply and go through the process, take the class and so on.
Right.
But if your child was under 18, they automatically became U.S. citizens. So, you know, there's four of us. So when my mom and dad became citizens, we automatically became citizens in that sense.
Right.
So I'm not sure if that still applies or if that's still, you know, I'd imagine that it doesn't.
How much has your work curating taken you back to Tijuana?
My work as a curator?
Yeah.
You know, half of my family still lives there.
Okay, so you go back fairly frequently.
I'm still influenced on going back, and I've worked with a couple of really amazing Tijuana artists as well.
Right.
As a curator.
But you've seen it change pretty significantly over the decades.
Oh, definitely. Like, you know, Tijuana's a lot more dangerous than Mexico City, you know, where it was quite the opposite before.
Right.
So any border city right now is more dangerous than a lot of other places in Mexico, you know?
Sure.
Outside of Sinaloa and that region.
Right, got it. So just to go back to your description of digging tunnels, what kind of tunnels were you digging now that you are an adult and know in retrospect a little bit more?
Well, the tunnel that we worked on the most was just to get across the street. It was weird because my uncle lived in this bungalow, and he was digging underneath to go across the street. And so we never finished it in that sense. It was a couple of summers in different locations, but, you know, maybe we would dig, you know, like 50 feet or more.
Uh-huh.
I'm just looking at distance right now, so I'm trying to figure out
how
much. But, you know, we were like 10, 11 years old, you know?
Yeah.
Child labor, you know?
That's crazy.
And this was like the crazy uncle, you know, this was like the first person in the family who actually went to the United States to work illegally. You know what I mean? He would go to Washington. He would go to all these different cities, and he was like a, you know, vagabond. I don't know.
Right.
And he was really adventurous. And so, yeah, I mean, next time I see him, I don't see him anymore. And he's quite old now, so the next time I see him, I'll see if he remembers what the hell we were digging for.
I just, you know, it's funny because I just finished reading this piece in The New Yorker about the tunnels, you know, of Sinaloa and how scary that whole situation is, not only, you know, from a smuggling standpoint, but the people who dig these tunnels, you know, the people, like, there, this, the first story was about this guy who went into this pizza place, who saw a sign, you know, advertising for a job or something like that. Or he went into a pizza shop in Tijuana and was and asked if they were hiring. And this guy overheard him and said, "I have a job for you," you know, and this guy ended up becoming a digger, you know, and you are an enslaved, you know, digger. And basically the threat is if you leave the property, they will kill you and your family.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's another body of work that I did maybe like a couple of years ago. And the whole thing is called Narquitecto, which is a mix between narco and architect.
Uh-huh.
And this is a term that was created in the Mexican press. And basically, when all this started, the narcos would hire architects and engineers to the cartels would hire them to actually design these tunnels. So, you know, they do work with really, really well-trained people to do this. And, of course, the digging is a little bit less... you know, it's more labor intensive, but you know, it's happening and it has been happening for the last 15 years, and it's very hard to step tunnels as
right.
well. So I'm not sure what type of new technology they're trying to use. But in the last couple of years, between Tijuana and San Diego, they found, I think, something like 15 of them.
Wow.
And they're all the same. You know, they have a little railroad tracking, air conditioning, sometimes lights, electricity. And they usually lead to a warehouse.
Does part of you feel like, Julio, that the more that all of this complicated activity continues, as bad as it may be, the silver lining is that you have a lot of material for your work?
Yes, definitely, especially now where it's global, you know?
Right,
The drug trafficking, there's... Now I started this other series of the same thing, people being caught trying to smuggle drugs. And, you know, one of my favorite ones was last year where a woman had fake dreadlocks and she tried to smuggle 4.5 pounds of cocaine in her dreadlocks. And the headline, and the series is called Narco Headlines,
uh-huh.
and it's exactly whatever it says online. It says something like 4.5 pounds of cocaine smuggled in fake dreadlocks.
Wow.
Or there's another headline that says, 3.5 pounds of meth found in nacho cheese. and so basically they're bricks or there's some kind of very creative way that people are trying to get products across. You know, the dreadlocks happened in Thailand. The nacho cheese happened in Texas. You know, so there's you're starting to see the impact of the cartels in Mexico globally now.
Right.
I'm kind of following that and working. Yeah, there is a ton of material to mine.
Yeah. Meanwhile, and this may be an irrelevant aside, but I can't help but think of it. When you read about the impact of the states that have legalized recreational marijuana and how that's affecting the cartels already, you know, and with the prospect of California taking that route, that it would affect it even more. I mean, is that something that you think much about, or and see that will? Do you anticipate that it will have much change, or do you think it'll just ultimately push them to another market?
Mm-hmm. I think another market, which will be basically a feedback loop.
Right.
And so essentially, right, you know, the United States is never going to legalize anything other than marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're starting to see now is, you know, I went to a party in Guadalajara a couple of months ago, and someone pulled out this spark plug that was, you know, you smoke weed in it. And he's like, "Hey, I have California weed." And so what's happening now is weed from California is now being smuggled into Mexico.
That's hilarious.
It's a reverse trafficking, and I think if I was a smart cartel person, I would fund Republican
right
campaigns to be right. against it if yeah. I want to keep my product.
Right. That's ingenious.
And so now you're starting to see these reverse type of smuggling where now, I mean, because this is the weed that they have now. Of course, this is, how do you say, the strains are calculated. And, you know, you take something so you can be awake. You take something so you can sleep, relax, and so on. So you have these what they call bug tenders if you go to one of these places, mm-hmm. and they'll ask you, like, you know, what's your problem? What do you need?
Right.
And it's really accessible and really cheap to get a card and also really cheap to buy weed. And so now you're seeing this weed because it has been identified as opposed to, like, you know, some weed that you're not sure what's going to happen after you smoke it. And so this weed is making itself back into, it's going into Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I mean, you can look at the history of drugs in Mexico and the United States, you know, and it started, you know, around World War II when the United States paid Mexico to grow opium.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. you know, from there went on to other things and so on. But that's really the sort of historical beginnings of, you know, United States being the largest country of assuming the drugs, of taking the drugs. And one of the largest suppliers is Mexico. So we're the biggest consumer.
Right. But I think feedback loop, I think that expression kind of says it all, the way you described it.
And the funny thing is, I'm here in Arizona, and it's legal to sell guns to Mexico. So
wow.
all the guns that the cartels have and this war on drugs is bullshit, because the same guns from the United States are ended up in the hands of the cartels, and so there's another feedback loop. They're using it against us or
right.
against the, you know, military or the police or whatever.
Right. So if you haven't done this series already, it's coming at some point, right, as your art?
Yeah, actually, I'm doing a show in November in San Francisco at a place called Gallery Wendy Norris.
That's the gallery. That's the gallery you represents you, right?
Yeah. And so all this new work will be there in November.
Great. Well, yeah. I hate to end it on a kind of weird, cynical question, but what's the market like for you know, for this kind of work? What's the collector
really
fervor?
It's not very commercial.
Right.
And the market I've found for my work is basically museums and collections. Like last year, the Deutsche Bank, that is a pretty amazing, serious collection, acquired some work that was based on you know, all the work that I do. And LACMA actually bought that installation from Sanitite.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So that's, you know, when I'm working with, like, Wendy, the gallery, it's not, you know, I'm working on another series that will be there based on the rise of beheading in Mexico. And so I'm working on that series that's more abstracted based on this imagery that you see in the media of cartels fighting each other. And what they're doing now is they're severing heads and leading messages.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes back to medieval times in that sense, you know?
Right.
And so essentially, I thought, I'm going to do a show. I'm going to do maybe a pop show. You know, I'm going to do a commercial show and sell some more.
Yeah.
And what I thought of was these beheadings, which is very difficult. I think it would be very difficult to sell, but they're more abstracted. And so maybe they'll sell. I don't know. Maybe a museum will buy them.
Right, right.
So, you know, I can't do a pop show. I can't do work that is nice and easy in that sense.
Yeah.
Or that is trendy, or, you know,
sure.
I just can't do it.
Yeah, of course not, and nor should you try to. But on the other hand, you know, devil's advocate, the undocumented interventions pieces, you know, as disturbing as they are on one hand, seem potentially desirable as collectible items on another.
Yeah, and I mean, that's like a strategy as well, is having them first and foremost be aesthetically pleasing or beautiful, and then people can research more of the content and
right.
where they really come from.
Right.
And that's the strategy that I take with all the work that deals with, you know, heavy issues or
yeah.
realities, is one, appreciate it as art, and then second, appreciate it as something social or something, you know, relevant in that sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Julio, this has been very enlightening. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Well, thanks so much, Michael. It's been awesome. I've been a big fan. I'm glad that I made it, thanks to Marco Rios.
yeah, I'm glad you made it, too. Thanks again. Thank you very much again to Julio. It's great to talk to him, and I'm honored to have him as a fan. A few things before we go. Stick with me another couple minutes. First of all, I wanted to remind you that you can support the show by going to theconversationpod.com and making a donation. And I mention that in particular because for the live podcast that we have coming up shortly, there's some additional equipment that has been purchased or is being purchased, including another microphone, mic stand, etc., those kinds of accoutrements. And we're also going to get some kind of speaker PA system for it as well. So if you wouldn't mind contributing a modest amount for that occasion, if you haven't contributed to the show already, it would be very much appreciated. And also, I wanted to remind you that I am indeed still inviting potential interns, whether you are doing it for credit through your art school or university, or if you're already out of school and just interested in helping on a production level, as a researcher, producer, social media person, etc. I would very much love to have your help. It's always in need. So if you get in touch with me through the website, or you can email theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. And one more thing, larger invitation to those of you listening. I've mentioned this before. If you have made an exodus, say, from New York to Los Angeles, which I know is going on quite a lot these days. If you have done so recently or in the last even couple of years, if you're doing so now or soon, would love to hear from you and ideally record your story. You know, it can be a short type of conversation about that, but I'm basically collecting exodus stories from anywhere to anywhere else. It can be in Europe. It can be in the Southern Hemisphere. Basically, if you left maybe a big city that was too expensive as some kind of art capital and you moved somewhere else, a little more modest, we'd love to hear your story. So get in touch. I look forward to hearing from you, and we'll put those, a collection of those stories together into an episode or two. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. I hope you enjoyed that, and I will talk to you soon.